Why does there seem to be such a broad consensus within political, academic, and media circles on the virtue of increasing Canada's military spending? Are mainstream peace organizations in Canada collaborating with an agenda of war? Does the replacement of the Harper government with the more congenial Trudeau government represent an improvement or a setback for Canadian foreign policy? Is Canada's recently announced defense policy an expression of national sovereignty or a capitulation to U.S. President Trump? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, on the heels of a recently announced Canadian defense policy, we devote the show discussing, with Canadian foreign policy critics Eve Engler and Richard Saunders, some of the misconceptions circulating around on what the country does on the world stage and why those misconceptions seem to persist. We'll also get a dissenting analysis from Engler of the newly tabled defense policy. On this week's program, Busting the Myth of Canada's Benevolent Foreign Policy, a conversation with Eve Engler and Richard Saunders. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of June 16th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. On Monday, Netanyahu announced his determination to block Europe from funding Israeli human rights organizations, the main watchdogs in the West Bank and a key data source for UN agencies. He now refuses to meet any world leader who talks to these rights groups. With Trump in the White House, a crisis plagued Europe ever more toothless and the Arab world in disarray, Netanyahu wants to seize this chance to clear the UN out of the way too. Global institutions such as the UN and the international law it upholds were created after the Second World War to protect the weakest and prevent a recurrence of the Holocaust's horrors. Today, Netanyahu is prepared to risk it all, tearing down the post-war international order if this act of colossal vandalism will finally rid him of the Palestinians. That comes from the article, UN Last Hurdle Before Israel Can Rid Itself of the Palestinians, by Jonathan Cook. Posted June 15th. Joint Chiefs Chairman General Joseph Fighting Joe Dunford lied to Senate Armed Services Committee members, claiming America's competitive advantage is eroding, limiting our ability to project power. U.S. military spending exceeds what all other NATO members, Russia, and China spend combined, with all categories included, including black budgets, more than $1.5 trillion annually, the so-called defense budget, one part of it. The Pentagon and related budgets should be sharply slashed, not increased. America's empire of bases dismantled. A new era of peace declared. For the first time in U.S. history, swords turned into plowshares. A polar opposite agenda is pursued. Permanent war is long-standing U.S. policy, bipartisan-supported out-of-control militarism, at the expense of vital homeland needs, social justice, and a nation fit to live in, drowning in hubris and arrogance, along with contempt for democratic values and the rule of law principles. That comes from the article, America's Forever War Strategy, by Stephen Lendman, posted June 15th. According to the Flemish father Daniel Mays, who has lived in Syria since 2010, the coverage of the Syrian war is based on lies. President Bashar al-Assad is not the problem, but our own politicians who support ISIS and al-Nusra in order to topple the Syrian government. Quote, the real terrorist leaders are in the West and Saudi Arabia, unquote. The 79-year-old father Daniel Mays is back in his native country, Belgium. He stays in the Norbertine Abbey of the Flemish village Postel, which he left for Syria in 2010 when the country was not yet at war. That was from the introduction to an interview by Eric Van de Beek with Father Daniel Mays under the headline, "Without Putin, Syria Would Have Ceased to Exist." Interview with Flemish priest living in Syria. Posted June 15th, 2017, originally appearing at Russian Insider. According to Bloomberg News, Russian cyber hacks on the U.S. electoral system are far greater than previously known. A big lie. Utter rubbish. The CIA and likely NSA and FBI can cyber attack targets anywhere, making it appear to have originated elsewhere, outside America, from any other designated country. Despite months of allegations, insinuations, and accusations, not a shred of evidence suggests any Russian hacking of America's November 2016 election or any other U.S. target. Claims otherwise are big lies. That comes from the article, "The Russian-U.S. Election Hacking Big Lie Got Bigger," by Stephen Lendman, posted June 15th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Canadians, even within the peace movement, have the impression of their country as positive, doing great works abroad as peacekeepers, and as slow to go to war. The reality, of course, is something else altogether. This week, following the release of the Liberal government's defense policy, we're playing an interview recorded only a few weeks earlier with Eve Engler and Richard Saunders. Eve Engler is an activist and the author of 8 books, including Canada in Africa, 300 Years of Aid and Exploitation, The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy, and his latest, A Propaganda System, How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. Richard Saunders is the coordinator of the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade. He's also a researcher and the publisher and editor of Press for Conversion magazine. I'm wondering if we can maybe have get some thoughts from you both about why it seems to be so difficult to inject any questioning of increased military spending, even though there's so many other whether it's climate change or healthcare, so many other priorities that we could be looking at. Why is this such an unquestioned idea? I mean, Eve, would you like to start off with some thoughts of your own?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that there's obviously very powerful forces that that just support increased military spending, and be it pressure from Washington, be it pressure from NATO, be it pressure from, arms companies within Canada that produce weapons, that fund a lot of think tanks that tend to drive the foreign policy discussion. These different forces are, aligned, pushing for increased military spending. And on the other side, there really isn't a countervailing force calling for diverting, the $20+ billion that Canada is currently spending on weaponry in the military, into a just transition away from fossil fuels. That's calling for taking the money that we're plowing into these weapons that are both ecologically and socially damaging, and putting that money into a national daycare program. So if in that situation, the corporate media in general orients itself around power, and they tend to echo the positions of powerful forces in society, and those all these think tanks that are aligned with the military and the arms industry,
the Global Affairs Institute, for example,
Canadian Global Affairs Institute being one, but there's numerous others. Conference of Defense Associations is a big promoter. A number of in my most recent book, A Propaganda System, I go through a whole series of different institutes in this country that are associated with the military, and they promote a pro military line. And if you look at all the money spent on think tanks that are promoting a pro military line versus money spent on the peace movement or anti-war position in this country, you'll find that the dollar figure is probably 100 or maybe 1,000 or more to 1 in favor of more military lobbying.
Hmm. Well, that's true. Everything you say is true. But even if the government gave more money to, or corporations gave more money to the peace movement or to progressive movements, we'd be even more in trouble than we are now, because so often, as you so well know, these NGOs, supposedly progressive social movements, organizations, are ending up spouting the same narrative that they hear from the mainstream media, from the government, from the corporations, and they're a big part of the problem. In fact, I think that's a pivotal key part of our problem is the, and I think you probably agree, that the progressive movement is actually oftentimes our biggest obstacle rather than being part of the solution. What I'm talking about is an institutionalized confidence scheme. So we have huge institutions, government, the media, churches have been deeply involved in these things with the residential schools and the whole genocide that Canada is based on and the land plunder that Canada is based on. They're all very deeply systematized, institutionalized confidence schemes in which the con artists themselves do not even realize that they are engaged in a criminal activity.
I'm wondering, just before you answer, Eve, I mean, I think one of the things that came to mind as you were saying that is the Haiti and the way the coup d'etat that took place there in 2004. Mm-hmm. And you had all these progressive organizations like Alternatives and mm-hmm. the Catholic Organization for Development and Peace all participating in that propaganda system.
They were
seemingly unwilling, because these are nice people.
Yeah, they're good, honest, decent, well-meaning people that are trying to do the best, just like the residential school administrators. I mean, there were psychopaths in there that were, torturing people and whatnot. There's no denying that. But the real problem is that it's a huge institution where the foot soldiers in this genocide are good, honest, decent people that think they're actually helping. They see the people that they're supposedly helping, who they're actually victimizing. They see them as sort of underdeveloped, they're uncivilized, they're savages, they're heathens, they don't have the right religion, they don't have the right, we have to help them. So we're going to bring them this, we're going to bring them that, we're going to bring them democracy, we're going to bring them to this, our technology, and we're going to make things better because we're superior, we're advanced, we're the civilized ones. And it's exactly the same thing that's been going on for hundreds of years, except now it's globalized. It's gone all over the world, and we can project our imperialism and our violence and our exploitation. Okay.
Let's give Eve a chance to participate in this. It's like he's speaking to Richard's speaking to a kind of like a pathology that's taken over. I mean, you have this institution that's not only putting out a lie, but the people who are putting out seem to believe the lie. I mean, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I mean, Richard's documented the role of NGOs, Canadian NGOs in Haiti, in very detailed and made quite amazing form that people can take a look at in the Coalition to Oppose Arms Trade website. And it's undoubtedly true that in the case of Haiti, I mean, the role of these supposedly progressive NGOs in destabilizing the elected government in 2004, justifying the coup, justifying, quite frankly, like all kinds of atrocities that basically unjustifiable. That's undoubtedly true. And, you take it into a different form. Haiti, I think, was a uniquely terrible instance of Canadian foreign policy and uniquely devastating role that many sort of progressivist groups played. Unfortunately, it was a bad case, but there's many other cases that are comparable or similar, and so it just kind of for me at least, it really just sort of opened my eyes to a much deeper problem. And I mean, it clearly, like, when you look at the NDP voting, supposedly progressive government voting twice in favor of a bombing and war on Libya in 2011, and still today never really apologizing or recognizing that there was this Libya is a catastrophe now, and it was, even if the country wouldn't have turned into the catastrophe it's turned into, it still was wrong to support the NATO war, to support the usurpation of Libyan sovereignty and whatnot. But the place is a total catastrophe, and so yes, there is a deep political culture. I've looked into the role of Canadian missionaries in Africa in the late 1800s. They played a important role in the colonial process. Literally a couple thousand Canadian missionaries were operating in Africa at the end of the colonial period, and they aligned with the colonial forces almost uniquely. I mean, there's some exceptions, but overwhelmingly aligned with the colonial processes and really enabled European powers to dominate the continent. In some cases, they were right there involved when there was massive atrocities taking place. So there's no doubt there is something very deep in Canadian political culture that's pro-imperial. You see it, like I said, manifesting with the NDP in Libya in 2011, the case of Haiti in the 2004 coup, and all the NGOs that supported that. There is something deep there. I think it is important to look at the institutional component of that. And yes, it's not just the looking at the dollar spent on think tanks promoting war versus supposed peace organizations. I think that that's not the only way to look at this culture that Richard's referring to and alluding to, but I think that is one way to get a grasp of the situation. And obviously, it's not just a matter of more government-funded NGOs or more government-funded think tanks that are call themselves peace organizations. There's a whole history of that with Trudeau and other governments that have funded these sort of supposedly more liberal peace organizations. They never were, of course. They were maybe not the total hawks, but they were still very much aligned with the government because that's where they were getting their money from and whatnot. It's more of a matter of building a people's peace movement that's really structured around not the the government or really structured around popular forces and that's I think where we're going to get more sort of genuine critical real peace movement demilitarization kind of policies and ideology that come out of that kind of that type of movement.
Responsibility to protect. I'm seeing all this a lot in the peace movement. There are people in the peace movement, the mainstream corporate peace movement, if you want, there are loud voices in there that are promoting this thing and have been for all those years. And they're the ones that were behind, the idea of going ahead with and supporting the no-fly zone over Libya. We had a very prominent peace activist, Ernie Regeer, who was the founder of Project Plowshares, and which is Canada's largest peace group, and he supported the intervention in Libya. When you have the country's largest peace group, the founder of that supporting that NATO intervention, my God, something's desperately wrong, and we have to face that. Difficult as it is, we have to face this fact that we have that our movement is, collaborating with the very people that we say we're supposed to be opposed to.
Yeah, I'd like to just kind of follow up from what you're saying there, because there's this meme out there that among the peaceful, the peace activist-y types in Canada, we're a nation of peacekeepers, not warriors like those guys in the United States. That feeds into this whole mythology
Whole mythology that I think it's the biggest obstacle that we have in the peace movement. It's a very self-congratulatory, we're so full of confidence. It's a narcissism. It's a social cultural narcissism. We love ourselves so much. And it's been going on for hundreds of years or thousands of years, It's a white supremacy movement, really. I mean, it's based on this, you can see it all the way through, the basis of the genocide in Canada, which is the founding reality of Canada. Here's another idea to try out on you, Eve. I think more and more, I think that Canada doesn't exist. Canada is a fiction. It's based on a legal fiction. It's based on lies and myths and it doesn't really exist. Yes, we have a we have passports, we have stamps, we have money, we have a government, we have on the map, it says Canada, we have boundaries, blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't, it's fake. And I'm not saying that the whole, that other countries aren't fake. But we know we hear a lot about fake news lately. Well, we have fake histories and we have fake mythologies and we have a fake country. What do you think about that idea? Is that too off the wall for you, or does that resonate with you somehow? Like, this is a fake country. There's something very, we are deluding ourselves here. This is not real. We've created, we've fabricated this nation. And, you know, you hear about nation building. You know, you over...
Yeah. Well, I think what we're talking about is, like, what exactly is a nation and to what extent its citizens kind of shape its policies as opposed to some cabal of shareholders or whatever. But I want to give Eve a chance to sound in on this.
I agree with a significant chunk of that in terms of clearly, you know, it's based upon obviously based upon genocide, dispossession, and based upon incredible lies that that much of the, you know, population believes. Unfortunately, it isn't a myth, because, you know, when the Canadian government and the Canadian military and you know, goes and overthrows an elected government in Haiti in 2004, it matters.
It's real. It's real in that way. Yeah, I know. In the same way that it's real because it's on a map, it's on paper, but it's also real in that they can take action and they can do things in the name of being. But you said lies. Now, that's another thing. Lies. Lie is only something, a lie, you're only lying if you know that it's not true. If you believe it's true, then it's not a lie, is it? Eve, you're talking about Canada's role in Africa and colonialism and all that. Well, the missionaries were on the forefront of that, of course. And Canada had actually, the of any country in the world, we had more missionaries, mm-hmm. 100 years ago. Or a little bit over 100 years ago, you know, we were the leading force in the world. They didn't talk about Canadian values then. They hadn't invented that fabrication yet, but they had what they called Christian values. So they were imposing their Christian values around
sort of
the
like
world.
A deeply ingrained.
But they really
kind
believed it. My point
thinking,
is, they really believed it. They thought they were
civilized. Not unlike a lot of the soldiers who go out to, like, peacekeepers who are going out to these areas and
or the people who willingly give their money to the confidence. Into the confidence scheme, right? That we willingly pay them to do this for us because, you know, we've bought into it, and we don't even know. The con artists don't even know that it's a lie.
I think there is there is element of truth in that, and that people do believe these absurd distortions about saving Haitians in the 2004 period around the coup, or saving Africans a century ago, the missionaries. But I do think, and I think there's degrees to which the people believed it, and there's degrees to which they did it because it served their personal interest there. And you see a lot of that with regards to the missionaries a century ago in Africa. You see that what they said about African society to a Canadian audience was not always what they were writing about privately in their diary. They understood privately that, in fact, they were the only reason they were able to survive often, or particularly early missionaries, was because they had local communities that were basically feeding them and being nice to them and treating them well. And then they would come back to Canadian audience when they were trying to fundraise and tried to raise money for their missions. They would say, everything is a horror story, the place is catastrophe, please give us money to change that. And I think even you'd probably even see some of that with regards to the NGO workers in Haiti in more recent times, if you were able to access their private diaries. So there is an ideology that people believe to a large extent, and I think that
to rationalize their behavior.
To rationalize the behavior, and then if you talk about the people who are who are giving money to some of these people who are not necessarily the ones who are the primary beneficiaries, but why are people willing to, people who say they're anti-war, give money to Project Plowshares while Project Plowshares' head is calling for bombing of Libya? You ask yourself, like, why would somebody do that? People there's a mix of the fact that I think people are genuinely confused. I mean, I think there are a lot of people that refuse to hear the truth, refuse to look at the fact.
They look away.
they look away when you start talking about the fact that, you know, this whole peacekeeping myth that we talk about, this whole peacekeeping thing, you know, well, it was a peacekeeping mission that, you know, Canada was involved in, assassinated Patrice Lumumba, independence leader in the Congo. It was a peacekeeping mission that, that overthrew and, you know, destabilized the elected government in Haiti in 2004. It was actually even a UN mission, slightly different, that was part of the Korean War of the early 1950s, where 3 to 4 million people were killed. So just because it's called UN peacekeeping doesn't mean anything per se. It can be in some instances, there are cases where it has been somewhat useful. There's other cases where it's been clearly just about Western imperialism and imposing our way and all that kind of stuff. So you know, we get down to the individuals, it's complicated between actual confusion, just, you know, believing this ideology. Sometimes there's some self-interest in there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, I think, a mix of different forces.
I thought it was interesting when you were saying about the missionaries that came back and they had to do their fundraising, so they're trying to get the money out of the churches, you know, out of the church members to, you know, fund their missionary activities overseas. The same thing happens now with NGOs. They need to fundraise. I mean, a lot of them get big chunks of money from the government, but they still,
from foundations.
And from foundations, right? And corporations, I guess, in some cases too, for sure. But they need to get money from their members, from the public. So how do they do that? Well, one of the ways that's very useful for NGOs to do that is to point to some success that they've had. So they said, oh, you should support us because we've had these successes, and they'll give you a list of successes. Well, one of the successes, for example, that peace NGOs have looked to, is that we kept Canada out of the Iraq War. We stopped the government from getting involved in the Iraq War. Well, that's a lot of baloney. Canada was deeply involved in the Iraq War, and I spent months and months and months documenting and detailing all the different ways that Canada was very deeply complicit. I'm talking about the 2003, escalation of the Iraq War. We were involved in all the way through the 90s as well in blockading the Persian Gulf.
I wonder, because it is a very persistent myth, just maybe one or two examples of how we supported the Iraq War in spite of the announcement in the House of
Commons. Well, our ships in the Persian Gulf were part of U.S. Fleets that, you know, we helped to protect those fleets, and our ships, our frigates, escorted the aircraft carriers right up to the doorstep of Iraq so that they could carry out their shock and awe bombing of the place. We had our generals second in command of the entire Iraq War through most of it. But the peace movement claims that you know, they stopped the government from being involved, and that's a huge myth.
You need
myth.
A win, basically.
And so you can point to that,
stay
and then
relevant.
You can say, hey, so that's a way that the movement can gain confidence from the public. And, you know, if the media tells people, you know, we should go, or first of all, the government puts out the heads of our government come out and they say, you know, we've got to bomb country X because they're a horrible dictator and we have to go in and help protect the poor people of country X. Then people will go, well, really? Governments have lied before. I'm not sure if I can believe that. Then the media tells them, you know, like tells them from every angle that, you know, every kind of media is bombarding you with stories about how horrible so-and-so is, and we have to go in there and protect the poor people of country X. You know, the responsibility to protect and all that. And so we go, well, I don't know. The media's lied to us before. But then if the NGOs come out, the peace movement comes out, the human rights movement comes out, the democracy movement, the development movement, they all come out and they tell us, you know, it's true, we're behind us, you know, the government is right. We, you know, much as we hate war because we're Canadians and we love peace and all that, we really have to, you know, bite the bullet and go in there and do X, Y, and Z with our good Canadian troops, and they need to get their boots on the ground or do whatever, then that's the public has the confidence of these movements. So that's a key thing.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Eve Engler, you wrote a a book a year ago on the propaganda system, and we've seen a lot play out since it was published. I was wondering if you've had any tendency to kind of amend, or maybe not amend, but maybe better, more examples or case studies that have come up that have really helped either shape or reinforce the points that you were making.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of see it every day, and that's my recent piece about the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. It's, you know, they have had this last 2 months since the federal government budget came down, which is, you know, funded by General Dynamics and Lockheed Martin. It's got different relationships with the Canadian military. They have been all over the media, basically saying we should be spending more money on the military. So, you know, when you just sort of pick up the paper, you see that the voices that are being quoted, the forces that are pushing more of this are, you know, some of the different, institutes that I've, looked at in that book. Dealing with the point that Richard making, part of the thing when doing the book, A Propaganda System, early on in that process, I did some on sort of how the left, let's call it like left institutions, have, you know, contributed to the propaganda around Canadian foreign policy. What I've subsequently done since publishing The Propaganda System is that I put all that into another text, and I've done a book about the role of the left in confusing Canadians about Canadian foreign policy. And basically, I think 90% of the discussion, 90% of the reason for why people are so confused is the you know, corporate media, the military's huge spending on PR and all these different arm's length think tanks. But I think, you know, 10% of the reason why Canadians are so confused about Canadian foreign policy is that the left institutions have either ignored the issue or explicitly contributed to the confusion. And so in this book that I've finished but haven't published yet, I looked at the role of the NDP and CCF, the history of their foreign policy. And, you know, they've often aligned with official Canadian foreign policy, supported wars, you know, from the Korean War, the creation of NATO, to up to today, you know, Libya, you know, putting boots putting troops on the border with Russia. The question of Palestine, the NDP has been, you know, supported basically all along, slight variations over the time, but generally supported. And you go on and on and on, and you find, you know, labor unions today, a little bit more critical, a little bit willing to criticize a little bit, but they mostly ignore the issue. For a long time, for a couple of decades, they were aggressively aligned with Canadian foreign policy. Then you start going into groups like the Rideau Institute, supposed peace organization, this country think tank, kind of be viewed as the main left wing sort of think tank in this country. You know, and there's some issues where I think they do some good work and they're willing to challenge, but then on a whole bunch of issues, they are, again, you know, they align themselves with Canadian foreign policy. And the head of the Rideau Institute, Peggy Mason, she's somebody who openly boasts that she was working with NATO. She's worked with NATO for many years. She did peacekeeping training for NATO for many years, and she boasts about that. So the head of what's supposed to be defined as the preeminent sort of left-wing foreign policy think tank in this country has, you know, a couple decade-long ties to Canadian foreign policy, ties to NATO, and I think that very much encapsulates just, you know, the state of play where there is very little in terms of institutional dissent around Canadian foreign policy. Mm-hmm. And so I think that what Richard's saying, I think that is true. I mean, there are so few voices that are saying anything different than what's coming out of foreign affairs.
I find it irresistible to bring up the question of Israel, since right now there's been a major action, the Palestinian prisoner strike, Marwan Barghouti and others who have been protesting the conditions affecting and the incarceration of Palestinians in large numbers. And that has gotten very little attention. As you've pointed out, there's something called Operation Proteus, in which Canadian aid, I mean, we're not even talking about military spending, Canadian aid is being used to enforce Israeli apartheid in the West Bank. And so that's one area that's completely invisible in the media. And it seems to me a lot of these other, the peace movement, well, maybe, I don't know, there's like the Palestine Solidarity Organization, but it's not getting the amount of attention that it perhaps deserves. And I'm wondering if Israel is kind of a unique case, or because it's almost the same kind of model. I don't know, Richard, we might be getting into a lot of trouble for saying this. You just finished saying Canada isn't a real country. And, you know, is Canada and Israel kind of like twins in that way?
Yeah, for sure. Well, they're both, there's a lot of similarities in them, for sure.
But does that kind of figure into, you know, that inability to, you know, the pathology that we've been talking about, and that inability to express it openly?
I'll jump in there for a little bit, just about Operation Proteus. And basically, the Canadian government since the mid-2000s has the bulk of Canadian aid money to the Palestinians has gone to training and creating a Palestinian security force to basically oversee Israel's occupation of the West Bank. And this isn't just coming. This is something that, you know, that I and John Elmer and other people have been saying for a number of years, but this is unequivocal fact. We have the internal government documents from the head of CEDA, former CEDA, Canadian International Development Agency, Margaret Biggs, in 2002, that stated explicitly that Israel is pressuring Canada to continue its aid funding to the Palestinians, and that she referred to Canada's training of a security force, which is under the direction of the U.S. Military, that it was about controlling what she put as, quote, popular protests in the West Bank. So popular protests against the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank and its complicity with Israel's occupation. So that's what Canadian aid. So you know, this was reported on in Post Media in 2013, and the recent piece I dealt with partly the fact that, so it was reported on a number of papers, internal government documents showing this, then just complete silence, no commentary around it, no mention of it for, you know, since that time. You know, no investigative reports about what Operation Proteus is about. Canada at one point was Canada's second biggest military mission after Afghanistan. So it's out there. We know it. This is what's going on. But it's just complete sort of silence from the media in terms of actually looking at it. And this gets into, like, what Canadian foreign policy is about. This is the best end of Canadian foreign policy. The aid end is the best end of Canadian foreign policy. You know, you got the military, you got the diplomatic realm that are, you know, more clearly aligned with, you know, corporate and, you know, military interests. And then the best end is the aid end. And even the point of Canada's aid, as stated internally by the president of the Canadian International Development Agency, was to oversee Israel's occupation, to protect Israel's interests in the West Bank, and you just get complete silence over it. And I think that, you know, there's a media component to that. There's also is this kind of component that the supposed progressive end, what they are more interested in trying to, you know, big up Canadian foreign policy, to find examples of Canada doing good things and how Canadian aid is a good thing. Much of what they spend their time lobbying for is more Canadian aid, even though we have many examples of Canadian aid being used to subvert democracy, in this case, prop up a 50-year illegal Israeli occupation of West Bank. So you know, there's many components to this, but this Operation Proteus is something that people really should look into.
I'm really glad that Eve has dug into that and found out about that, and I really hope that more people will learn about it, because it's really important. I looked into companies that helped support the Israeli apartheid through military, police, surveillance, and the prison system, and found that, you know, $5.5 billion worth of Canada Pension Plan investments were going into companies, those kind of companies, military, police, surveillance, prison companies that were directly assisting the Israeli apartheid system. So that's a way that Canadians are forced into complicity in the in this criminal activity, in this occupation. We have no choice about it, because, you know, they take our money and put it into those. I mean, we're profiting from it, basically.
Well, we're in the lead up to the 150th anniversary of the creation of what we call Canada, and it's
We're in it now.
Yeah.
Well, I guess July 1st.
Which is fascinating with all the talk about reconciliation and the fact there were people here like a lot longer than 150 years. But I imagine you're going to see a reinforcement of all of this mythology as we get closer to that anniversary. Mm-hmm. But that does kind of lead me to another point I wanted you both to comment on. Now, Eve Engler, you wrote a book called The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy. And I know that in the last election that there was a lot of mobilization to get Harper out of there. And so I don't know to what extent that was for Trudeau as opposed to against Harper. But, I mean, yeah, they did stop Harper. But now we've got Trudeau. And I don't know that we can really say there's been a huge change in our foreign and military policy. So I don't know, Eve, if you'd like to comment. Can we expect the Ugly Canadian Part 2 with Justin Trudeau's face on the cover? Or what's your take on the new regime?
The Pretty Canadian.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the changes have been, or the improvement, should I say, are very limited. I do think that I prefer a Justin Trudeau to a Stephen Harper on foreign policy and on other realms as well.
Why?
Because I think that the bellicoseness, kind of the rhetoric's a little bit dialed down. I mean, I think you got to look at each area, right? So you take like Palestine. You know, Trudeau just put out a statement 4 or 5 days ago for this Israel rally in Montreal, and the statement's very bad. I mean, it's got the world upside down in terms of, you know, who's right and who's wrong, and it kind of basically saying that Israel is you know, doing good and all this kind of stuff. It's still not the degree of the aggressiveness of the Harper rhetoric. If you take a look at Iran, it's you know, Canada still hasn't restarted diplomatic relations, but it's still not that same kind of rhetoric as aggressive as Harper. You take a look at, you know, Eastern Europe, they're continuing with the sort of policies of troops on the border. There's a whole lot to disagree with, but again, I don't think it's quite as aggressive. And you know, so this is you know, not far from a government one should want, but I think it's a question of lesser evils. And I'm not it doesn't get me excited by the idea of a lesser evil government. But I do prefer. I think, you know, politics aren't you know, I never expect anything close to perfect or even, you know, sort of what's right. But degrees of bad are relevant.
But Eve, if you were talking about the statements and the rhetoric. But, okay, that's fine. It's great. It's better to have rhetoric, I guess. But if the reality behind the rhetoric is basically the same, is it better to have the good rhetoric? Or is the good rhetoric that we're hearing, is it actually part of the problem? Because that dupes people into thinking that things are getting better and that they don't have to be mobilizing or protesting.
Yeah, I'm just going to maybe we've got time for maybe one more point to raise. And Eve, if you wanted to respond to what Richard said, I'll give you a chance to. But basically, I'm concerned about, you know, to what extent it is possible to redirect as people, if the message through this radio station and through you know, websites like Global Research or your own eveengler.com or the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade, if we're able to undermine and debunk a lot of these myths, is it even possible to redirect our foreign policy? Or is the infrastructure of the state with military harmonization through NATO and the United States, military contractors and so on, is it so well entrenched in the architecture of our state that it is impossible for a new bunch of elected representatives to change our foreign policy? You have any thoughts about that?
I think in the short term it is. I think if you got an NDP government in power tomorrow, you would not fundamentally change Canadian foreign policy. I think that it's too entrenched institutionally and ideologically to imagine any sort of profound change overnight. I agree with that completely. Is it possible? Of course, it's definitely possible over time, but that's a question of changing the balance of forces in our society, and that's where building peace movement or anti-war movement, demilitarization movement, building explicitly anti-imperialist movements, movements that are you know, more generally challenging the whole, you know, history of Canadian foreign policy and the whole way of looking at the world and those sort of power dynamics. I think that that is all possible. And I get to sort of answer the question about the difference. There are actually some differences. If you look at the Trudeau government, they're still, you know, way too militarist for my liking, of course. But, you know, in the most recent federal budget, they didn't increase military spending. There's many reasons for how that plays out. But I think that there is, you know, some faction of the Liberal government that does prefer to put that money into more useful things. I'm of the opinion that, you know, the budget should basically be slashed 10-20% a year and that money moved into socially useful things, you know, kind of immediately. But there are some tangible, it isn't just the rhetoric of Harper. I think the rhetoric is mostly, but there are some tangible kind of policy elements. But the main issue, and I think this to the, can we change this, is revitalizing popular anti-war, popular anti-imperialist, popular socialistic, let's call it, forces, and building a, you know, the movements in this country that are going to fundamentally transform not just Canadian foreign policy, but, you know, the inequities of our society more generally.
Okay, Richard, if you could give you the last word.
Oh, I just hope that Eve's right, that it is possible. The whole institution of war and exploitation, slavery, these things have been going on for thousands of years. Now there's been the rough edges. Some of the rough edges are worn off of it. May not be as sharp as it was, but it's, in many ways, it's worse because now our weapons are much more advanced. You know, our systems of exploitation and means of obliterating people are much more advanced. So in some ways it's worse, in some ways it's better, but I think it's been going on for thousands of years, and I don't really expect it will ever stop. But we have to keep trying, because we can try to make things better. I'm not saying that we should give up, but I'm just saying we have to be realistic and not expect a utopia.
Okay, well, I'm afraid we got to go now, I want to thank you both. It's been a very, very stimulating, if somewhat depressing, discussion. Richard Sanders of the Coalition Opposed to the Arms Trade and foreign policy analyst and writer, Eve Engler. That interview was recorded in early May 2017. On Wednesday, June 7th, Canada's Liberal government released a document called Strong, Secure, Engaged, Canada's Defense Policy. The new policy calls for an increase in annual military spending over the next 10 years from the current level of $18.9 billion to $32.7 billion by the 2026-27 fiscal year. Initiatives include spending on more fighter jets and on no fewer than 15 warships. We are told these initiatives are necessary to secure our national sovereignty and project values of peace and democracy at a time when the U.S. under President Trump is abdicating its role. To help get a better sense of what the new defense policy does and does not do to protect Canadian sovereignty, the Global Research News Hour brought back Eve Engler for his thoughts on the subject. Could you speak to what you saw in the defense policy document that leads you to believe it is less about protecting our sovereignty than actually about capitulating to Trump's America?
Well, yeah, I mean, the government, how the Trudeau government tried to lay this out was Foreign Minister Freeland had a speech on Tuesday about how we have to, you know, be weary of Trump's foreign policy and, you know, think about pursuing our own path. And, you know, one of the things cited was Trump administration pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord. And then the next day, the defense minister
Canadian Defence Minister Sajjan came out saying that put forward this defence policy, which includes increasing military spending 70% over the next decade, increasing the number of fighter jets, moving forward with the $60 billion naval upgrade, increasing the number of special forces, more than 600 new Canadian special forces. These are highly secretive special forces, improving the military's capacity to engage in offensive cyber warfare. So this is really about what's being announced in the new defense policy is really enhancing Canada's capacity to dominate militarily around the world, but being framed by Freeland speech that this is about sort of a more independent path. In the actual defense review, they use the word interoperability 23 times, according to one analysis. Well, interoperability is all about the Canadian military being able to fight with the U.S. military. So, it's just complete absurdity. The Trump administration was pushing Canada to increase military spending. What the Trudeau government has done is put forward a plan to substantially increase Canadian military spending and offensive military capacities, but under the guise of pursuing an independent path. This is just the sort of standard of the Trudeau government, where they put forward sort of kind of nice sounding rhetoric, and then they pursue policies that support empire, that support corporations abroad.
Do you think that there are ways that, we're used to thinking about the military funding as a key to protecting our national sovereignty, and all the cynical packaging aside, are there other dynamics undermining our sovereignty currently that we may be overlooking? The population. The spending in the Liberal defense plan, actually endanger Canadian sovereignty?
Of course it does. If there is an institution in this country that would be an anti-national institution, it would be the Canadian military. The Canadian military is the upper echelons of the Canadian military have very close ties to American generals, American military. They integrated into U.S. military world. This goes back decades and decades, where the Canadian military officials are the ones pushing for bringing in U.S. nuclear weapons to be able to be stationed in Canada, going back into the 50s. The Canadian military is not oriented towards defending Canadian national sovereignty. It's oriented towards fighting wars of the U.S. empire. In terms of questions of sovereignty, if you want to look at that question more broadly, I think questions of climate change is something that does undermine Canadian sovereignty. Doesn't undermine Canadians' ability to control their lives. Well, more spending on the military, buying more fighter jets. The Department of National Defense is the largest emitter of carbon emissions in this country. There's almost no analysis of the Canadian military. The Canadian military's incredible ecological toll. There's some analysis of the U.S. military's ecological toll, but generally environmental groups in this country don't look at the question of the Canadian military's ecological footprint. They should. That's something about undermining Canadian sovereignty.
Just to interrupt you a bit, there is a commitment to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 40% by 2030 within the plan. What do you think of that?
You don't buy more fighter jets. If you don't spend your time, you don't put billions and billions of dollars into more fighter jets. If you're looking to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, that's not. It's the same general policy. You don't build new pipelines if you're looking to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So from the standpoint of like fighter jets, the best case scenario is all they do is waste carbon emissions in training. The worst case scenario is they waste carbon emissions in training, and they also kill people by dropping bombs on people's heads. This is rhetorical. This is talking about reducing carbon emissions and then increasing fighter jets, naval vessels is just more of this rhetoric of, you know, talk a good green game and then pursue policies that serve you know, imperial and corporate interests.
Okay, could I just maybe just to finish up, if you were in a position to draft a defense policy for promoting the protecting Canadian sovereignty and for promoting authentic Canadian values or benevolent Canadian values abroad, what are some of the key points that you would highlight?
I think in the short term, this goes back, laid some of this stuff out in the Black Book of Canadian Foreign Policy. These are not revolutionary moves, but I think moves that would be in the positive direction. One thing would be to reduce Canadian military spending 10% a year and come put forward a plan that explicitly talked about, if you do start significantly reducing Canadian military spending, there's going to be people who are harmed by that. So you need to figure out a way of finding employment for those people in other areas. So shifting that spending towards a green transition that keeps in mind some of the people who are harmed in the short term. I think there's a question of pulling out of NATO. Canada should pull out of NATO. NATO is not, NATO has never been about defense, and it's certainly not about defense. It's certainly not hard to argue it's about defense post Cold War. This is an entity that's bombed Libya, occupied Afghanistan, bombed the former Yugoslavia. This is an aggressive offensive organization that Canada should pull out of. Also in terms of the actual deployment of Canadian troops, if you're going to deploy Canadian troops, and I think that for the most part if you look at Canadian foreign policy, it's so oriented towards elite and corporate interests and so tied to U.S. empire that deploying Canadian troops should very much be a last case scenario. But in the case where there should be discussion of deploying Canadian troops, it should be about changing the format of the UN. And instead of having the Security Council control deployment of troops, it should be about the General Assembly. Right now it's in the hands of the small body dominated by the five permanent veto powers. So that's some of the direction I think you go. But when it gets right down to the question of the narrow question of Canadian security or national sovereignty in the most narrowly viewed way, i.e. military intervention. The reality is there's only one country in this world that is in a position to intervene militarily in Canada, and that, of course, is the U.S. And the whole Canadian military strategy in recent decades and going back even further, post-World War II, has been oriented around supporting and enhancing the American military. So it really to claim that putting money into the Canadian military today in this way is about national sovereignty is just absurd.
Eve Engler, I want to thank you once again for joining us and sharing these thoughts with us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been joined by Eve Engler. He's an activist and author of 8 books. His most recent is A Propaganda System, How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. His website is yvesengler.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.